I just don't have the strength to go on. I'm not saying that right now. But that, maybe that is something that you have said or you've heard someone else say. I said it at 7 a.m. on Friday morning this week. Catherine and I decided to get up, do a little bit of exercise, sort of before the day really gets going. And rather than go for a run, because you can't go for a run at the same time, leave the kids unsupervised, there are those exercise routines you can get on YouTube, yeah? So 30 seconds exercise, 20 seconds rest, 30 seconds exercise, 20 seconds rest. Out in the garden, it was a beautiful morning, warm air. The garden was feeling refreshingly cool. Seemed like a superb idea. What could possibly go wrong? After about 5 minutes, I had collapsed in a deck chair, gasping for air, thinking, I just don't have the strength to go on with this. And the most humiliating part was hearing a little tap from one of the upstairs windows, and all of the kids were standing up there laughing at us down in the garden. Catherine did much, much better than I did. Just don't have the strength to go on. Mark Zuckerberg is the Facebook guy, 33 years old, founded Facebook. He's obviously just a very brilliant individual, but he dropped out of Harvard before he graduated. So rather surprisingly, they invited him this last week to go back and give this year's graduation speech. Maybe not that surprising. He's the fifth richest man in the world. He's worth $63 billion. I guess Harvard had an eye on some of that cash, and that's why they invited him back. But he finished his speech by saying these words. He said, "Before you walk out of those gates for one last time, as we sit in front of Memorial Church today," he said, "I am reminded of a prayer that I say whenever I face a challenge, that I sing to my daughter, thinking about her future when I tuck her into bed. It goes like this. May the source of strength who blessed the ones before us help us to find courage to make our lives a blessing." Now, I have no idea whether Mark Zuckerberg means that as a genuine prayer or simply a good thought, as it were. But it is a good thought to end a graduation speech on. As you begin the rest of your life, you're gonna need strength from somewhere to live it. Life is a challenge. And actually, to give him credit, most graduation speeches or winner of the latest TV reality contest speeches or whatever kind of speech it is tend to be absolute nonsense. So the truth is, despite what these speeches often say, you can't do anything you set your mind to. You can't be whatever you want to be. You aren't the last best hope for planet Earth. You shouldn't always follow your dreams. That's probably a disastrous thing to do. You shouldn't always believe in yourself. That's definitely a disastrous thing to do. And you shouldn't expect life's most meaningful gifts to come through unchecked self-expression. But, you know, you're amazing. Follow your dreams. Never give up. That's the kind of advice that we often hear, isn't it? But life's a bit tougher than that. Things don't always turn out the way we wanted, and what we need is strength to be able to face the inevitable challenges. Where does that strength come from? The totally tragic events in Manchester at the beginning of this week, they've just been deeply distressing to see it, hasn't it? And you know, we want to weep with those who weep. The mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, said a few days ago, he said, "We are grieving, but we are strong." And that's right, tough times need to be met with strength. But we don't always know where we're going to find that from. I just don't know how I'm going to find the strength to go on is a feeling that I imagine not a few grieving hearts are experiencing this Sunday morning in Manchester. Do you remember that poem by Rudyard Kipling? "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too, If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If, poem goes on like that, doesn't it? And the key word in the poem is if, all the way through again and again. That is the question. If you can do all these things, but yeah, where do I get the strength from to do those things, to live like that in adversity? And there'll be struggles here this morning. There are always struggles here. Struggles with people, struggles with jobs, struggles to do the right thing that we know is the right thing, struggles with suffering, struggles in relationships, struggles with loneliness, with grief, struggles with kids, struggles with holiness, struggles to serve or struggles to love, struggles just to keep going, just to keep going, to endure. With all those struggles, where do you get the strength to meet them, to face them? David wrote Psalm 29 to encourage us in exactly this area. Look how it ends, verse 11. Got it open, verse 11. The Lord gives strength. The Lord gives strength to his people. The Apostle Paul prayed for his friends, for the churches that he planted, that they would be able to keep going in the Christian life. And he knew they needed God's help to do that. So one of his prayers was, Colossians chapter 1, he prayed that God would strengthen them with all God's power according to his glorious might. And Psalm 29 is here to encourage us to pray, help us to pray that kind of prayer, to encourage us to look to God, who is gloriously powerful, to look to him to give us the strength that we need. And the thing is, if we forget this, if we forget that God is gloriously powerful, then we won't look to him for strength. We'll fall instead for that modern day lie that we should somehow find strength within ourselves. Look within. And David says, don't do that. Don't do that. David says, listen to me. It's the Lord who gives strength to his people. And he can do that because he is a God of great power and majesty. So do you see that in verse 1? Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. And verse 4, the voice of the Lord is powerful. And David says, listen, the angels get that. Nature, the storm we're going to see in a moment, proclaims that reality. So really the psalm asks, how about you? God is a God of glorious power and might. The angels get it. The storm proclaims it. How about you? Let's look at it like that, this psalm. So first of all, the angels get it. The angels get that the Lord is gloriously powerful. That's who David is talking to in verses 1 and 2, in case you wondered. So he says, verse 1, ascribe, he's talking to the angels, ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe just means give. So he's saying, you angels, he's saying, you know what your job is in life. It is to give God the credit for who he really is. It's to sing his praises, what he's really like. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due to his name. And glory is a funny word, isn't it? Glory is a funny kind of word. It's kind of hard to define, but I think it's one of those words. Someone asks you, what does glory mean? You go, not quite sure, but I know when to say it. I know when to use the word. So thousands of Arsenal fans got home yesterday evening saying, we won! It was glorious, yeah? It's the right sort of context, kind of, to use it, okay? We all got our summer clothes on Thursday and Friday because the weather was glorious. Glorious days, weren't they? I got up early this morning to finish this talk and got up early enough to see the sunrise. It was glorious as I flung open the curtains and tried to bring myself into this world in a conscious way. But it was glorious. And God is a glorious God. Glorious is the word for something spectacular, for a display of beauty or splendor or skill or majesty or strength. The Bible says the whole earth is full of his glory. Well, what does that mean? It means that everywhere you look, you can see the amazing creative hand of God. The world is a display of God's glory, his strength and his power. You can see it everywhere. So, I don't know, are you a David Attenborough fan or a fan of those sort of nature programs? Do you watch them? They've been on telly for as long as I can remember. I've grown up watching the David. I remember my nan loving them and watching them. I remember watching them with her. They're just utterly brilliant programs, breathtaking photography. You can't watch one of those programs without being blown away as Attenborough waxes lyrical about what you can see in the natural world. But have you noticed in them, there is never any mention of God? And the thing is, we're so used to God being excluded from the conversation that that doesn't even strike us as odd. Odd that the Maker shouldn't even get a mention. It's not even odd, it's outrageous when you think about it. My parents are in Italy at the moment, and they keep texting me photos of artwork they've seen, you know, the traipsing around galleries and stuff, and pictures, paintings, sculptures, that kind of thing. And you look at it and you go, oh, that's good. Who's that by? And when we see the sunset or the stars, that's the question that should be on our lips. Who's that by? You see a brilliant painting, you think, that's extraordinary. Who painted that? We should ask the same question when we see the world around us. Who's that by? It is glorious. Whose glory? God's glory, of course. He says, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. And that's what the angels get. They see it, they get it, they know it's his, that the world proclaims it. Only he doesn't call them angels just here, does he? Did you notice that? That's why it's a bit puzzling at first when you read who's he talking to. He calls them mighty ones. What would it be like to meet one of these mighty angels? We know exactly what it would be like to meet an angel because people often meet angels in the scriptures. And whenever anyone meets one, they are terrified and fall flat on their faces in fear. Glorious, powerful creatures, mighty ones. And yet, what do these mighty ones do in the presence of God? They ascribe glory and might and strength to him. You think we're mighty. It's you, O God, who are the God of glory and power. They get it. And if they get it, if such mighty creatures get it, do you see down in verse 9? David wants us, feeble creatures, to say the same thing that those mighty ones themselves say. Do you see in verse 9? All in his temple cry glory. The same thing the angels say. That's the aim of this psalm, to get us to say what the angels are doing. Get us to do what the angels are doing, saying, God, you are glorious, you are powerful. We see it all through the world. God is gloriously powerful. The angels get it. Secondly, the storm proclaims it, because that's what's going on in verses 3 to 9. King David gives us this bit of the psalm, verses 3 to 9, it's like King David's own version of one of those Attenborough nature programs. So we'll call him King David Attenborough at this point, okay? And you have to read this section of the psalm in a kind of Attenborough voiceover. That's the sort of, I can't do it, but just sort of imagine it like that. And if this was an Attenborough episode, this episode would be entitled The Storm. David describes a Middle Eastern thunderstorm just here. So if you were here last week when service was all a bit weird and we had a civic service and everything, we were looking at Psalm 8, and you're meant to read Psalm 8 by moonlight. The words of Psalm 8, Paul read them for us a moment ago in the prayers. When I consider the moon and the stars which you have set in place, read Psalm 8 by moonlight. Or Psalm 19, you're supposed to read Psalm 19 by sunlight. The heavens declare the glory of God, it says. So read Psalm 19 out in the sunshine today, if there's any left. But Psalm 29? Psalm 29, you're supposed to read Psalm 29 by, don't know how you say it, lightning light, okay? Read it as the lightning flashes. Read it in the storm. because that's what's going on here. It's a description of a storm. It's poetry, so it took me a while to cotton on as I was reading it this week that that's what's going on in these verses. But what he's doing is he's describing the progress of a storm. And he describes it sort of bubbling up over the waters, that is, over the sea, over the Mediterranean. So over the waters, he said. And then the storm comes inland, over Lebanon, over Mount Syrian. Then he describes it turning southwards, which is towards the wilderness of Kadesh. We're not very clear on the geography, are we? But that's what's going on here. The storm comes from the sea, over the mountains, down through the country. He describes its progress, and he describes its power. He mentions verse 3, the thunder. Verse 7, the flashes of lightning. Verse 8, the ground shakes. Verse 9, the huge trees get broken and split by the lightning, and so on. And do you remember the storm a couple of... You've been out in a big storm. You remember the storm a couple of years ago that battered the Hoe in the winter? And it was so... the waves were so strong that the hostelries on the front there got a battering, and the waterfront pub got washed out, and the wet walk became the really wet walk, and they had to sort of close, didn't they? I remember the storm that evening. I was out and about visiting someone, and I love a storm. So drove down the front of the Hoe, and you could feel the spray coming on your face from the waves as they crashed there. And I read the paper the next morning. They were advising people not to go down to the Hoe to have a look, but you kind of can't resist it. There's something terrifyingly attractive about seeing such power at work. The power of a full-on storm is full-on terrifying. And do you know when a lightning bolt strikes, the lightning peaks at a trillion watts? I don't even know what a trillion is, but it sounds a lot. And then the surface temperature, I'm not quite sure what surface temperature means in relation to lightning, but the surface temperature is 20,000 degrees centigrade, which is three times as hot as the surface of the sun. It's extraordinary power, isn't it? That's raw power that you see in a storm. And what David helps us to remember is that the storm is God's storm. How does he do that here? He says that deep and terrifying explosion of thunder is God's thunder. It is, as it were, the voice of the Lord. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord strikes with flashes of lightning. It's his creation. It's his world. It's his thunder. It's his. The angels get it. The storms proclaim it. God is powerful and mighty. How about you? Do you see how this psalm goes? It goes from heaven to earth to you. So from the mighty angels who acknowledge God's glorious power to the powerful storm that proclaims that glorious power to us, to God's people who, well, what do? Verse 11, all in the temple cry glory. So I've got two questions for you. Do you say that? Do you think that way? And second question, if you do, how do you say that? Do you say it? How do you say it? So do you say it? I mean, when you see the splendor and glory that is there in the world, or of the storm in particular, for example, here, do you recognize it as a display of God's glory and power? And say to yourself, God's glory is on display here, you know. Glory. I gather there was a spectacular lightning storm on Friday night. Did anyone see that? I snored my way through it. I was completely unaware of it. But if you saw it, did you say, glory, how mighty is our God? It's good to get in the habit of seeing things like that, seeing the world and saying, I know who made that. And he is glorious, he is mighty, he is powerful. And when you do, when you see it, when you say glory of something, how do you say it? Because you get the feeling that here in verse 9, it's said with a sense of wonder and awe and worship. But you could just as easily say it with fear, couldn't you, when you see the power in the natural world that there is. Lightning is terrifying, but how much more, therefore, terrifying is the God who created lightning? Okay, it belongs to him. Imagine, what could that God with that kind of power do to me? Well, we don't have to imagine, because verse 10 reminds us. Look at verse 10. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. Do you know, there's only one other place in the whole of the Bible where that word flood appears. And you can probably guess where it is. It's right back near the beginning in Genesis chapters 6 to 9 and the account of Noah and the flood. And do you remember what God said? Genesis 6 verse 12, here we are. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people. And can we honestly say that we're any better than they were then? God's power, in truth, ought to be terrifyingly frightening to us. Or do you remember that story in the Gospels of Jesus in a boat with his disciples? And as they were in the boat, a storm blew up. Do you remember the story? And the winds blew and the waves went shh, and the rain went all this. This is what I do with my kids when they're scared at night. We go through this story, okay? And the disciples were seasoned fishermen, and yet they were terrified of the storm. And they said to Jesus, Jesus, don't you care what's happening to us? And Jesus said, why are you afraid? And he stood up. And he said to the wind and the waves, quiet, be still. And everything was calm. And the disciples asked themselves the question, who is this who can command the wind and the waves? And they obey him. And it says, they were afraid. Not of the storm anymore. Afraid of him. Who wouldn't be with that kind of power? And yet, of course, fear of Jesus, in that terrified sense, is not the tone of the rest of the New Testament. They didn't carry on being afraid of him, despite his mighty power. And the turning point for them on that was the cross of Jesus Christ. When this mighty one, quiet, be still, and it's quiet, that mighty one hung on the cross and died for our sins. They looked at the cross and they knew that as sinners, they were safe with Jesus. God's power was power for them to forgive them, not power against them to crush them. And that's why the people in the temple could say glory with a sense of wonder and worship rather than with a sense of fear, which is the way pagans have often looked at the natural world. And wondered, I wonder if this is a bad omen for me. The Christian never thinks that. The Christian thinks, glory. My God is a God of great power and might, and I know because of Christ, his might is for me, not against me. Do you know that? David wants us to know that the Lord gives strength to his people. And David is speaking out of personal experience here, just to finish off. The Psalms leading up to Psalm 29 are full of trouble and strife and David struggling with this, that, and the other. What should I do, he asks. Where should I look to find strength for the struggle? And Psalm 29 is his answer to that question. The angels get it. The storm proclaims it. God is gloriously powerful and he gives strength to his people. So as I say, there'll be all kinds of struggles in our lives here this morning, struggles with people, with relationships, struggles with jobs, with health, with suffering, struggles with grief, struggles with kids, struggles with holiness, struggles to share the gospel, struggles to serve, struggles to love, struggles, I don't know, just to keep going. And there may be various wise things that you need to do, various sources of help, various ways to cope. But one thing you have got to do is to turn to the Lord. The Lord gives strength to his people. Given who he is and what he's like, Let's be people who ask him for it. That's the one thing that I want you to take away this morning. Let's pray together.